Okay, here during January 83, I recorded an interview with Fred Haddock over the telephone to Michigan, but there was a tremendous buzz, which is a disaster, and I've summarized it all on paper, and one can begin the next interview over these present remarks. In other words, consider the rest of the tape blank. Okay, this is talking with Gerald Hawkins on 9th June 1984 at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., and we're going to focus on the very early years of meteor radar astronomy. And I'm looking at the interview that was done in 1973 with Dr. Hawkins by Nigel Gilbert for some of the comments. So starting off on the first page of this transcript, you mentioned that you went, indeed, in 1946 for a short period to Jodrell Bank, even as you were an undergraduate, I guess, at that time. Can you tell me how
yes,
that came about?
I wasn't even an undergraduate.
Oh, really?
I'd been accepted for Nottingham University, and I went for the Perseid period, which was August, the first 2 weeks in August. And then, in September, I immediately went to Nottingham University. So I was really...
just out of high school, as we said.
Just out of high school, right. Actually, I was sailing around the East Coast in a small sailboat I'd bought, and mixed in that sailing with helping Lovell.
Well, what was your job?
Didn't have one.
No, at Jodrell.
Excuse me.
At Jodrell
yes.
Bank.
Well, I was the expert visual observer. They were very rare beasts because Prentice had worked up this team of amateur astronomers who worked all night and studied school all day. When the sky was clear, and he had really about a dozen people, of which two or three he felt were his experts, and there was, of course, G.E.D. Alcock of Peterborough, the famous comet hunter and Jupiter observer, and Prentice and myself. We formed almost an equilateral triangle between Peterborough, Great Yarmouth, and Ipswich, or Stowmarket. So when Lovell said, I want some help, Prentice went himself, and then next time round, he asked me to go. I went officially. I was paid my travel, and with all modesty, I felt extremely proud to be helping this great science. I didn't know what science was about at all, except that I had studied meteors purely because I was interested in doing something astronomical. The trouble in growing up in England was you can't study astronomy.
Yes, you mentioned that in this transcript.
So the next best thing was to be an amateur. And I would go out at night and log the meteors, the time, the position among the stars. And during the war, I got into serious trouble many times. I may have even told Gilbert, police officers and air raid wardens took this with very dim view.
Right.
And I was evacuated, so I lived in various houses and was thrown out in many billets because I studied the stars. It was a suspicious thing.
But what was your job at Jodrell Bank, though?
Yeah, I was the visual observer.
Right.
The visual observer.
But can you
called.
Describe more what the experiment was, what the setup was?
Sure. They didn't know what a meteor was, and they're very transitory things to see. In fact, we now know you can't observe them visually. They any recording you make with the eye is distorted, the movement of the eye, the angle of the head, but I was to give the visual recording as we were trained to do it, putting a piece of string along the line of the flight of the meteor, plotting it among the stars. Logging the time, I had a little press button, and inside the hut they had this trained astronomer outside who would tell them what was going on. Their only connection was the umbilical cord of the switch, but they didn't know that the astronomer outside in his deck chair, sitting lying back looking at the sky, could hear what was going on inside the hut. So so I had a two-way connection, really. So they just relied on me. I pressed the button, I said, that was a big one, and I would then record it, and they would sometimes get a delayed echo, as it was called, because it was not specular to their antenna beam, which unfortunately they were directing vertically upwards, which was not any common sense angle for detecting meteor echoes.
Now, was that, would that really be clear at that time, or is that hindsight?
I would expect so. But I didn't know enough about what they were doing to know that what they were doing right. was wrong.
Well, why do you think that they should have realized that?
Well, of course, Hay's work had brilliantly shown that you could detect meteors by specular reflection. He detected a radiant point that Prentice identified as a delta acquired meteor stream. It was hinged entirely on mm-hmm. the specular nature of the echo. Lovell himself had calculated the reflection coefficient of columns of ionization, and surely the mathematics and the physics and common sense would have said that you should point the antenna beam at right angles to the meteors. Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps they didn't realize the direction that the meteors were coming. There seemed to be this feeling on their part, must have been the feeling on their part, that the meteors traveled horizontally.
That they can shoot across the sky horizontally, yeah.
Which I never understood. If I'd known that that was an error, I would, of course, been able to mm-hmm. point out that these meteors were coming down vertically. Although, even myself, I think it's difficult to go back to that time, but even I didn't quite have a feeling that these meteors were falling at angles. They were projected on a dome, as we're sitting
sure.
here, and you don't quite get involved in the reduction, the trigonometry.
Right.
Ultimately, we'd know that the beginning height was 102 and the lower height was 95, and it must have had some vertical motion. But to actually imagine it as a three-dimensional mm-hmm. thing in a two-dimensional dome is difficult.
Sure. So, how were they recording? Did they have a strip chart recorder, or were they just, once again, just noting down when they saw blips?
Very old-fashioned eyeball, mm-hmm. looking at the old green tubes that were used for detecting aircraft echoes.
Mm-hmm.
They had extended the range from zero to at least, I think, 1,000 kilometers on the with 250-kilometer marks. It was full of grass. It was a very serious eye strain to sit looking at that tube. They put their eye about a foot away from the grass to get a good view.
Mm-hmm.
And when they saw an echo, they just noted it on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm. And so this was the Perseids
yeah.
in 1946, and we were just looking at a 1947 paper by mm-hmm. Lovell that probably included those results. We'll have to check that out.
We could check it out.
Yeah.
But certainly I think Prentice went even earlier.
Yes, maybe, Lovell talks about Prentice going earlier.
45?
Yeah, I think so, late 45.
Gosh, yes.
Very late 45.
Yeah. Oh, he might have gone for the Geminids in December.
I think that was it, right.
I think that's why he sent me. It was cold.
Right.
He decided he didn't like it. Well, but it was a very muddy field.
While we're talking about Prentice, can you tell me how you see his role and then your role also of the amateur meteor observers as opposed to the radar, what came to be known as the meteor radar astronomers? What was the relationship there?
Well, Prentice was an absolutely critical figure. He was a stimulating speaker, a solicitor, and an absolute fanatic on meteor astronomy. He had observed meteors from his teens.
Mm-hmm.
He had actually observed so intently and got so frustrated with lack of progress that he had a psychological breakdown in which he lost his sight for 2 years.
Hmm.
Well, I'm not sure that it was 2 years. So that he was Mr. Meteor, there's no question about it, and Lovell was fascinated by him. And Lovell is a man who gets excited about anything that's scientific or intellectual. I would say Prentice was absolutely critical. He was absolutely critical for Hay and Parsons.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only just one of Prentice's boys. I was only 18.
Apprentice, I might say.
Yes, apprentice to Prentice.
Were there any other people beside you two?
I don't think he sent anybody else out. Oh, no, nobody else went out except...
Mm-hmm.
Prentice went once or twice. I think he went for the... No, he didn't go for the Jacobinids. I don't know who went for that. There may have been another person, but... I don't recall.
Right. And you also just told me that you were the only one in the media radar group after you joined it in 49 who had a background in amateur astronomy. Like,
I was the only person at John Robb Bank in 49 who knew anything at all about astronomy. And I hadn't been trained.
Right.
In 49 I had been trained as a physicist because you can't study astronomy here was the rule. And they were physicists.
Right.
Basically.
But you were an ardent amateur.
I mean, I would have said I was an astronomer at the age of five. Yeah, I was absolutely keen on the whole thing. And in fact, being relegated to meteors was not any choice of mine. when you don't have equipment, when you don't have a telescope, what more can you observe? You can observe variable stars.
Mm-hmm.
And meteors have the excitement of something dashing into the atmosphere and burning up.
So you arrived in 1949 as a...
Officially, as a graduate student,
right,
as it was called.
And as you say here in the transcript, Lovell just said, you go in that hut and you start working on this problem. You had no choice whatsoever.
Yes, instantly, after telling me that I had performed absolutely shamefully in the exams, and which, of course, I didn't believe. But
yeah.
But he was delighted to have me there, although he wouldn't go into it in too much detail because the knowledge of astronomy was zero.
Did the group lean on you for the astronomy?
Oh, yes.
Knowledge?
Well, yes. There were many embarrassing discoveries that I made. The radiant positions were coming out 2 or 3 degrees off the positions that I knew were the correct ones. And within, I think, 2 months, I had determined that there was a 2.5 degree error in the alignment of the radiant meteor radiant antennas, aerials, and it was because Clegg had surveyed them, forgetting that Manchester was 2.5 degrees west of London.
Ah.
And then, of course, it's a natural mistake. He hadn't corrected the longitude in the timing. He'd shot everything well with transit instruments, but the aerials were skewed.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't make much fuss about it, except to state that I had redetermined the, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And we had to actually correct it, I think, in a publication. He had given the azimuth at one value to begin mm-hmm. with, and we had to correct it. But that was an absolute astronomical
sure.
error. Well, 2.5 degrees is astronomical as well.
Any other examples of this kind of thing, where lack of background in astronomy led to...
difficulties?
Yeah.
Yes, the discovery of the daytime streams was not done by any sheer intellectual brain power. Mm-hmm. It was done, it was a serendipitous, serendipitous, exactly.
Right.
In fact, there was, Banwell was involved, and he, and Parker, and one or other of them, I think it was Parker, did tend to fall asleep at this green tube at night, and he had not turned the antenna sufficiently, and the screen was full of echoes in the daytime, and that was the discovery. Look, sir, what I see.
So you're saying that, in retrospect, you think that someone should have sat down and said, well, look, there should be some daytime streams, we should spend some time looking.
Oh, yeah, but my mind goes right back as a time machine, and there was no way that that could have been done at that time, because there were no astronomers in the country.
Yeah.
Who knew about astronomy?
In the country?
Well, there were a few at Cambridge.
Right.
There were none at Manchester University.
This is before Copal arrived?
Well, Copal came on the coattails of Lowell's work.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, it got to be a crying need. We need an astronomer.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly when they were getting signals from galaxies.
Right.
What's a galaxy?
Right.
No, the astronomy was thin on the ground. Then John G. Davis came along around that time, J.G. Davis, and he was an intensely knowledgeable amateur on astronomy. And he had a very fine way of speaking to Lovell, and he then tended to educate Lovell on mm-hmm. the astronomical things in a polite way. We had many discussions at lunchtime. We all ate together, and afternoon tea, which is an English custom, so that it was a slow educational process. But to imagine that any brainstorming could have been done mm-hmm. to state, well, we should get this, therefore let us see if we can observe it. Well, I discovered the radio echoes from the Aurora Borealis absolutely by accident. And I instantly knew that it was the Aurora Borealis. This was 1950. Because I had seen the display, and I knew what the Aurora Borealis was.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think Lovell would, or anybody there.
Yeah.
In fact, I used to be asked big questions such as, what's that bright star up there?
Mm-hmm. Right.
That was the level of the astronomy.
Sure. But you say that almost... From what you say, it sounds like an awful lot was happening accidentally, but yet there must have been plans that well, look, we want to find this out, so we'll design this piece of this aerial to do this. Really nothing like that in this period, say, up till 51, or you got your degree in 52, I believe, up till that period? Or did you see any changes along that line in the time you were there?
Yes, the whole subject got set in cement. Radio stars were named radio stars, the signals from the galaxy by Hambry Brown. No, it was a tremendously productive period, and there was an international network that was set up in mm-hmm. that period, and of course right. the Cambridge group influenced Lovell mm-hmm. tremendously, even if it was just by sheer competition.
Right.
And then the Australian group, and we had visits from them, their...
Fozzie and Bowen and so forth. And
Bolton. And
Bolton also.
His work on the reflections of the Taurus source setting over
right.
the
ocean. The sea interferometer.
Oh, it was
right.
fantastic, yeah. Mm-hmm. So all of that happened in that period. I'm really only talking about the 1946 period. The general capability of Jodrell Bank had changed immeasurably between 1946 and 49. See, in that period, when I was at Nottingham University, it did build up, mm-hmm. and when I arrived in 49, it was set out as it is today, with a green swath of, mm-hmm. of about 4 acres, a perimeter road, 4 or 5 huts, mm-hmm. each one dedicated to a different subject,
mm-hmm.
Moon echoes, mm-hmm. radio star scintillations, radio meteor echoes. So what I'm saying of the early fumbling was the 1946.
But now the longitude error, that was after you arrived, though.
Well, that was built in when I arrived.
Or had been made before, yes.
It had been made before,
right.
Yes.
Yeah,
that was already, and it still is, the antennas are skewed by that amount, although I visited 2 years ago and they've been taken down.
That corrected the error, right?
Yeah. So it's just a time frame that right. we're really putting straight there.
As I was saying to you before, I'm very interested in what you see as the key intellectual questions in meteor radar astronomy at that time. What were the things you wanted to find out?
What is the amount of ionization that is being produced? Can it generate the E layer?
Mm-hmm.
Can it cause sporadic E? That was a fantastically burning question for Lovell.
Right. Of course, this is not straight astronomy, so there's a lot of ionospheric physics.
Absolutely.
More
than 50%.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the velocity of the objects became interesting from the physics point of view, but then when orbits could be calculated, it enlarged into the astronomy. Whipple came over, and I think it was 1949,
mm-hmm.
and Lovell had met Whipple, I think, not to travel to the States, but in some other connection. And Whipple again influenced them. He said, why? You should be observing the Beta Torrid stream. And they found they were. And then he said, these things are connected to comets. So we may have interstellar meteors. Let's get looking. And Irpic's papers were all ready to mm-hmm. read. So it was a very dynamic period. And then the astronomy focused on my job, which was mapping the meteor streams in the solar system. It was a, can you imagine? We are going to map all the meteor streams across the Earth's orbit
mm-hmm.
because we have day and night capability. We used to say to visitors through right. rain and fog,
right.
or daylight. And
ideally suited for England.
Ideally right. suited. Yeah. We'll get them. If they come in, we will get the velocity and the radiant.
Mm-hmm.
And we did. I was with Lovell 2 years ago and I said, you know, really that big question of the meteor astronomy, as it was called, I said, really, we don't see much about that now. You and I really finished it off, didn't we? He said, you may say that in my presence, but only in my presence. Don't tell anybody else. But it was really true. His book, mm-hmm. Meteor Astronomy,
right.
it was quite an event because mm-hmm. there was nothing in the literature. Olivia's book was not much use. The basic shock to me was to find that all of my work as an amateur visual astronomer sitting outside working with the triangle of people
right.
was wrong.
In what respect?
We could get the heights of the objects, but we couldn't get the velocity.
And why did it go wrong?
We couldn't estimate the time of duration.
Because of the limitations of the eye?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And also, we tended to twist the track with systematic errors. The clue to our problem was that big, bright meteors would always focus on a very definite radiant point in the sky. But fainter meteors came from a much broader area of the sky, and Prentice said, well, that shows that the heavy objects are undisturbed by gravitational perturbation. The small ones are perturbed, so we have cores in the meteor streams. Well, it was a good excuse for bad observations. It really was that the bigger, the brighter the object, the better the visual observer could see it. So I came away with all of my 3 years of work on the radar studies, realizing that I hadn't contributed much at all as an amateur visual observer.
But of course the background was invaluable, though.
Without that starting block.
Right. Now, so you seems like you credit Whipple then with inspiring Jodrell Bank to pursue this question, which became rather central in the ensuing years.
The ERPIC problem of interstellar meteors.
Right.
Absolutely. ERPIC was stimulating too. But what was happening was that Lovell was responding to stimulus in the literature and with scientific people. Number one, it gave him a reason for doing what he did. Number two, it got his interest going. And number three, it justified what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Why we're checking up on ERPIC's work. It may all be wrong. And he could tell people.
Tell me about the 218-foot dish, which was built by Clegg and Lovell, officially with the purpose of trying to go for cosmic ray showers. At least it was designed with that purpose.
That was his only purpose.
But it never did.
No, it was
such
a complete goof from the purpose it was built for.
Right.
Absolutely. Again, why was it made to point vertical? Again, they thought the cosmic ray showers were becoming in horizontal, and that
they would be going the same. That's
but
right.
They would come down vertically like meteors.
Yeah.
Cosmic ray showers, apparently, he required to this thought that they'd come in horizontally. That's why it was a dish on the ground with a vertical mast.
Right.
And the disaster was that... It